From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. Rick Kite is widely recognized in the La Crosse area for his insights into ethics and how ethical thinking and decision-making affects our lives. Kite is director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. In an election season when we're routinely bombarded with political claims and counterclaims, it seems only timely that he's published a new book on ethics that forces us to think hard about what we hear. His book, An Ethical Life, A Practical Guide to Ethical Reasoning, touches on selected controversial issues and decisions that have been made in recent years in the La Crosse area. Rick Kite told Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis that the book helps fill a void in the teaching of ethics.
This is not a book that I really was looking to write. It came more out of necessity. As director of the Ethics Institute, I get asked frequently for suggestions of things to read in ethics. And it's just from people who are like in business or in healthcare or their parents. They just want to know better, like how to make better decisions for themselves or with their employees or their kids. And I would have a real hard time finding something that would be a good basic book in ethics that would teach somebody a little bit about the history of ethics, but just what the general terms mean, and in a way that would really help them practically make better decisions. And I struggled the same thing in our classes that I was teaching, that I thought we just aren't doing a very good job of teaching ethics, because the classes seem designed more to prepare students for taking the next higher, more advanced level ethics course, not really just in how to make better decisions. And most of our kids, they're not going to be majoring in philosophy. They're going into business or maybe into engineering or law or something, and they just want to know, how do they make good decisions in their lives and in their professions.
Are there a lot of ethics books out there?
Yeah.
That can be used in the classroom? And what separates them from the book that you've written?
There are thousands of books in ethics. I would say there's probably hundreds of books that are current right now that are for use in ethics classrooms. And they're divided really into two, that kind of the theoretical ethics books and then the applied or practical ones. Mostly what we do for introductory ethics classes for undergraduates is we teach applied ethics. That is, how do you take these theories and apply them to cases that you might be involved with? What I didn't like about the approach of almost all of them, they were counterproductive. What they would do is introduce really fairly complicated theories, and usually with readings from, say, the 17th, 18th century, Immanuel Kant or John Stuart Mill, and introduce these theories of consequentialism, deontology, natural law theory, and then say, okay, now you've learned something about this theory after 2 or 3 weeks. Now apply it to an almost impossible case. Here's the case of euthanasia. Now, how do you resolve that? Or how do you issue capital punishment or animal rights? Well, these are issues in which society is deeply divided. So now you take a 19-year-old kid and you say, okay, you've done some reading for a couple weeks in a theory that you can hardly understand, and now try to apply that to a case that society can't come to agreement about. And I've had many of our students who just kind of give up and say, well, all these smart people disagree on what's right or wrong. I don't really understand the reasoning, so it must be just whatever you think is right is right. And that's not really what we want to accomplish in an ethics class. And so I wanted to take a different approach.
Is this book for students, or is it for a general audience that's interested in ethics?
It's from an academic publisher. It's written as a textbook for students, but I thought that what I wanted to do is write a book that students would actually read and make it readable and use a voice that isn't very common in academic textbooks, that is, use more of a conversational tone and as far as possible use everyday language. The aim was to write a textbook that would also be the sort of book that anybody could pick up and just read and find accessible and even enjoyable.
The book lays out the concepts and many of the misconceptions about ethical thinking. There's a lot of misconceptions. I didn't realize there's at least a dozen, maybe more misconceptions that you outline in the book and talk about. Could you talk a little bit about one or two of the common misconceptions?
One common misconception is that Ethics is relative, relative to culture, relative to individual opinion. And that's something I think it's good to deal with right away at the outset, that that actually the way that we use ethical language, we talk about it, we make judgments that apply not only to ourselves, but to everybody in a relatively similar situation. And there are real cultural differences in the way that we understand situations, the way we talk about situations and so forth. But the cultural differences tend to be about particularities. And what we have to recognize is that there's kind of universal ethical concepts that underlie cultural differences. And once you notice that actually there's widespread agreement in cultures about that lying is wrong, that stealing is wrong, cheating is wrong, once you recognize that, you can see, well, no, that ethics is not relative. There's some basic kind of underlying concepts that are common to everybody.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. Our guest today is Rick Hyde. He is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership and a professor of philosophy at Viterbo University. He's also the author of a new book, An Ethical Life, A Practical Guide to Ethical Reasoning. The book also deals with the four ways of ethical thinkers: truth, consequences, fairness, and character. Is that a new concept you're introducing to readers, or is that your view of ethical thinking?
This is the view that I've come up with over a couple decades of teaching ethics, that there are theories, but the theories that we teach as philosophers are really, they're really sophisticated developments of just natural ways of thinking that we all learn from the time we learn to speak, and that whenever we are involved with either thinking for ourselves or in discussion with others about what's right or wrong or what's good or bad, we fall back on one or more of these four ways of thinking. And so one of the basic ones is, what is really going on? What's true? And what's the context of the situation? I would say this is one of the really unappreciated ones, is that most disagreements involve misunderstandings between people about what's actually going on, what the situation is. We tend to assume too readily that we share the same information, share the same background or understanding of a situation, and we don't. So this is one. The first thing we have to do is say, well, what is the truth? What's going on here? But then these other ways of thinking about consequences, about fairness, and about character, these are all just things that we learn from an early age. You know, a parent will say to a child, how would you feel if somebody did that to you? Well, in philosophy, we call this reversibility, putting yourself in the other person's position imaginatively. Okay, but you don't need the complicated term of universalizability or reversibility to know what it is. You learn it at a very early age, and it becomes a natural way of thinking about things, is putting yourself in the other person's position.
One of the interesting things in the book is the number of real-life examples you take of debates about issues that have gone on in this area. Could you talk about one of those cases and why you're using it to illustrate, I guess, one of the principles in your book?
One of the cases I talk about that happened in this area was the Mathey construction case, when Mathey purchased a tract of land in Bryce Prairie, located just north of La Crosse, and intended to build an asphalt production facility there. And the homeowners in that area, of course, didn't like the idea of having an asphalt production facility right across the street from their lakefront homes. And this is the sort of thing that happens in communities all the time, that you have people with different interests will disagree on what's going to take place. What I found really interesting, and it's also typical, is that as the process went on and there was more and more disagreement, people in the community seemed to get angrier with one another over the issue of not being able to come to an agreement about it. And I started looking at letters to the editor that were written to the La Crosse Tribune. And it was fairly predictable that there was there was not just a disagreement about different interests, the homeowner's interests versus the employees of Matthey Construction. There was a difference in ways of thinking about this, okay, that caused a misunderstanding, that most of the homeowners were thinking mainly in terms of consequences. If the production facility is built, what will be the result? And what will be the result for traffic on the roads, for property values, for potential pollution into the lake, for air quality? It was all focused on consequences. For people associated with Matthey Construction, and there were letters to the editor from employees or friends of employees or relatives, the concern was about fairness. It wasn't about consequences. It was about, well, this land had been zoned for industrial use, and you can't change the rules in the middle of the game. That Matthey Construction had always been a very good employer. Isn't this the kind of employer you want? And this is a character concern, but it's not a consequence concern. So when these arguments in a public case like this get repeated, they're aired publicly through the newspaper and radio and television and so forth, what happens is you have both sides kind of talking only to themselves, and they're using two different kinds of thinking without knowing that they're using two different kinds of thinking. So there's no way of reconciling the two sides. And one of the reasons I wanted to use real cases like this is so that you can show, well, how do we get in situations of misunderstanding? We're trying to agree on what is the right thing to do. And then how could we possibly come to some sort of resolution? And it seems to me the first thing we have to do is recognize that whenever we engage in these discussions, we're not always using the same language, right? And we have to have then a little bit of patience with the people who disagree with us and see, well, now, are they talking about the same thing I'm talking about? Are they using the same kind of reasoning that I'm using?
That is a great example of, I think, a lot of things that are going on in this world right now that people don't agree about. You know, it might be a microcosm and confined to Western Wisconsin, but, you know, you can apply that to most of the other things that people disagree about, can't you?
Yeah, certainly. I think if you look at our political debates, it's just a very interesting thing to do. Is when you get candidates or supporters of candidates talking about what policy they support, look at their ethical reasoning, and you can usually identify: are they saying this is a good plan because of the consequences of it, because it treats people fairly, because of the motivations that produce it, in other words, character. I mean, you can identify that. And very often in the disagreements, what you find is that there's differences in ways of thinking about it. That's something that we have to pay attention to if we want to come to some sort of resolution.
One of the points that I felt the book raised is the fact that in life there is often no one right answer to many of the ethical dilemmas that come up in life. Do most people realize that?
In some ways, it's kind of a loaded question. I think in most situations, there isn't a right answer, and there's an obvious right answer, and so we don't even talk about it. And in most cases, say, of theft or lying, things like, I mean, there's a pretty obvious right answer. So then it's not a controversy. But then when the controversies come up, the reason we talk about them so much is because it's so hard to find the right answer. And now those are relatively few actions in our all of our human life, but they're the ones that give us real trouble. And often we can't come to a resolution because we don't have enough information about what's really going on. It's not a problem caused by a failure of ethical reasoning so much as caused by the limitations of our knowledge.
Your book doesn't talk a lot about politics, but we are in the midst of in election season, and there are always ethical questions raised come election time. Which politician is telling the truth? Who has the best character? Those are two of your four points, you know, and you can probably apply other points to politics as well. What advice do you have for the voter who is dealing with this at this time as they try and wade through the information and make the most informed decision?
I would say the most important thing is to ask questions and ask serious questions to try to get more information. I think most of us, we would rather be affirmed than to be informed. And we kind of seek people who agree with us politically because it gives us a sense of comfort with their identity. But politics is difficult because we're trying to agree on public policies that affect different groups differently. And so with just about any policy, there are winners and losers. And it's very important to try to become informed about how those policies really affect everybody, and not just how it affects me, but as a voter, I'm kind of responsible for voting for those candidates and those policies which advance the common good. And so I've got to step back a little bit and try to find, now, what is the truth here? And let me give you an example where I think this doesn't work very well. It's in very complicated legislation, like the health care reform. When that was being debated a couple of years ago, it was very easy to find people who either supported it or criticized it. But it was very difficult to find anybody who had actually read the legislation and knew what it said. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of experiments I did in writing this book is trying to find out, well, of organized groups that have taken positions on these issues, on political issues that are really controversial, how much do they really know in advance of making their stances? And I called different think tanks and organizations that had taken strong positions on healthcare reform and would call them up and ask their spokespeople about very specific questions. Most of the time, what they would try to do is convince me why they were right to take their position, but couldn't answer just the basic factual questions about what was in the legislation. And this seems to me very dangerous for a democracy, that we jump to taking positions on issues without really understanding what they are.
A lot of people believe we're living in a time where politics, the system is broken and the country is more divided than ever. As an ethics and philosophy professor, how do you view what's going on with elections today and politics in the United States?
Well, I think that this idea that that the system is broken, that things are getting worse, and that we're going rapidly downhill, this is the viewpoint you would find at any time in our history. If you would ask people, what's your opinion of politics right now? That's the answer you would get. And in fact, you not only would get it, for the last 200 years in the United States, you would get it just about in any society in history. If you look at like letters from Roman senators and so forth, you find that sort of thing. You find it in Victorian England. You find it in all kinds of places, this kind of remorse or regret that our society is becoming unraveled. So first of all, you have to take an historical context. Oh, yeah, we've got a lot of problems. We tend to focus on the problems, not on the good things, so that provides a kind of distorted perception. And then you just have to be practical and say, well, what can I do to make things better, you know, in whatever area of influence that I have?
Rick Kite is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. His new book is entitled An Ethical Life, A Practical Guide to Ethical Reasoning. He spoke with WPR's John Davis. Newsmakers continues in a moment with a debate from candidates in Wisconsin's 94th Assembly District. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. We also welcome your comments and ideas. Simply follow the links on our archives page at wpr.org/lacrosse.